You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in three delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Find it now at TraceMinerals.com.
Good evening and welcome to this evening's episode of The Mary Trump Show. I am thrilled and honored to have as my guest tonight, Soledad O'Brien, journalist, host of Matter of Fact, a correspondent for Real Sports with Brian Gumbel, and executive producer of the extraordinary new documentary, The Rebellious Life of Rosa Parks, which premiered on Peacock on October 19th and is absolutely essential viewing. Soledad, thank you so much for joining me tonight. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Thank you. And thanks for having me. Yeah, it's a good doc. We're really proud of it. You know, I think Rosa Parks is one of those people you think you know, and and then you kind of realize like, oh, actually, I don't know Rosa Parks at all. And everything I learned in seventh grade was pretty not accurate. So it was a good project to work on.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many reasons people should be seeing this documentary. It's beautifully done. It's so relevant, which is tragic, actually, but something we need to discuss. It's information all Americans need to have. But one of the things that struck me about the ways in which Rosa Parks' story has been literally reduced to one very small moment in her life, as much of an impact as it had.
And kind of accidental, right? Like one small moment and she was just a little tired from a long day. And, you know, it was kind of this accidental civil rights hero, which of course is a complete misrepresentation of her life and her work.
Yeah. And it's a really good exemplar of how Americans, well, white Americans, have crafted the teaching of the civil rights movement. We have this situation in which a few individual figures like Rosa Parks have been singled out and again mythologized in a way that completely undercuts their real contributions. You know, as Jesse Jackson said in his eulogy of Rosa Parks, she was a freedom fighter and she was a militant. You know, this was not some passive, quiet old lady.
Friends with the Black Panthers. She liked Malcolm X as much as she loved Dr. King, right? Which is a contradiction of sorts, but in her mind, she fully understood, you know, she supported them both. You know, the people who were really willing to consider violence and people who were focused on nonviolence. And I think in a way, the rebel side of her has been written out. And we were very curious and like, why, you know, back in the day, I used to think so many things were unintentional and accidental. Yeah. And then as you get older, you're like, oh, it's all intentional. but, you know, exactly that, like this idea of why is it so much easier to sell a palatable story about a woman who just one day got sick of it and accidentally, you know, kicked off the most successful boycott in history versus telling the hard story of someone who literally worked their entire adult life in order to try to find justice for people, especially racial justice in this country? And, you know, why is the second version not quite as palatable as the first?
Yeah, and I think again one of the important things that this documentary illustrates is that it's because of what Black people were fighting against, and it wasn't simply segregation, which was bad enough. It was the unremitting, unrelentless, and horrific violence they suffered at the hands of white Americans. And I think we're seeing now how that has led us to this moment where, after centuries, certainly, and in the decades of the 20th century, white Americans have been unwilling to face their past. We have governors like DeSantis and others in red states wanting to completely erase the real history of America.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's a lot of times I think journalists have helped them along. I mean, a lot of my work has been in trying to bring forward stories. And it's not always an easy sell. You know, I early on when we would do documentaries like Black in America, and we would want to tell the story, people had videotaped themselves and their interactions with police. So this was, you know, what, 10 years ago. And, you know, and it would be a hard sell to get that on TV news in some capacity, even in a doc series called Black in America, you know, because the sort of sense was like, well, we don't really know the whole story. We're not really sure. I mean, the police are saying this. And so I think journalists have often been very reluctant to embrace what has been well known in the Black community around certain kinds of interactions and certain kind of histories. So, yeah, I'm always just really curious about like setting the record straight in the doc. You know, it's just, one of the things that I didn't know was that Rosa Parks, one of her jobs was to take notes on people who had these very horrific, you know, things happened to them. So she's going and taking the story down of Recy Taylor, a woman who's raped by several white men. They say, we're going to kill you if you tell anybody. And she goes and reports it, and they still, nothing ever happens. And I remember, you know, hearing, so Rosa gets on a bus and goes quite into the rural part of the country, and the sheriff's car is going back and forth while she's taking this woman's testimony. But like, who sits there and takes a testimony that you know nobody's going to care about, right? Like, it's never going anywhere. The case, no one is going to work for justice for Recy Taylor. No one is going to, Recy knows, Rosa Parks knows, right? Like, everybody's aware. And I always sort of love that part of the story because it does matter. Right? I mean, to me, it's like, this is why you become a journalist, because it actually does. Maybe at this moment in time, it won't get the attention it deserves, but she's going to take those notes for posterity. Somebody, someday, somewhere will care about Recy's side of the story of her rape. And it just was so heartbreaking because, you know, there was so much violence and just, and so little expectation of justice, right? I mean, and to still fight on anyway is kind of remarkable.
That moment, I agree. That was one of the more powerful moments in a very powerful documentary for that very reason. These are two women unsupported, knowing that there is no justice here, doing the incredibly difficult work of creating the record, knowing that it won't change anything for them. But that was one of the things about Rosa Parks. And we'll get into this in a little bit, but you know, the work she did, at some point, I think she knew that it had to be to get the next generation to understand why it was important for them to take up the fight. Did you see it that way? And I'm also curious about, you know, what your thoughts are about her. Well, and again, it wasn't an evolution. This was not a woman who believed that nonviolent resistance was the way to go. But what kind of impact do you think her willingness to be very direct about the kinds of potentially off-putting or the kinds of strategies that might in the short run have the kind of backlash that, you know, typically would want to avoid, but knowing that that was the only way that things could possibly get better. And even so, without doing them, things were horrible. I mean, you know, she lived in Detroit during those riots. So given the fact that she was really a solitary figure, which I found kind of heartbreaking, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, it was so interesting to me. I hadn't realized, I mean, I did once we started digging into the project, but that after the Montgomery bus boycott, she never worked again. She and her husband never worked again. They literally, there was just, the first time she had health insurance was when she joined John Conyers' staff. She'd been you know, organizing and agitating for 30 years and had and never had health insurance in her entire life. I mean, it was just such a, you just sort of think like, oh, well, you know, the way the story goes, right? She sat, you had the bus boycott, it was resolved, everybody goes back to their places. And no, actually not for Rosa Parks. She was in a desperate poverty, actually, for much of her life. And a lot of the benefits that came to the folks who were working in the, you know, in this for civil rights really didn't accrue to her, even though she held this position, right? Everyone yeah. called, you know, the first lady and this and that. But in terms of actual money, in terms of actual support, she had zero, you know, virtually none. So, yeah, it's I do think that it's just an interesting way of, once you begin to understand that she was actually just a badass from the get-go, and that her vision of what America could be was going to require something very aggressive in her mind. It's why she agreed to talk to students. You know, she was Rosa Parks. She was the famous Rosa Parks, and she would agree to sit on juries and do all these things, and also, you know, get honorary degrees for the work that she had done. Like, she sort of, you know, understood that she had these dual roles. And, you know, I guess for me, the only thing that I find frustrating about that is you hate for people to think that the battle for civil rights is one of just, it's just like a stumbled upon accident, as opposed to it actually is a long, long fight where people have to be very aware. It's not just one day, one person does a thing and boy, that sets everything into motion. It's actually a real long term, decades long, sowing the seeds and doing the work, which is a less charming story, I think, than a sweet little old lady gets tired and decides not to, you know, give up her seat. And also that, you know, she was just hardcore about it and paid the price in many, many ways.
Yeah. Well, you know, the real version is certainly less palatable for those people who don't want to be challenged. But what was really fascinating, and I didn't realize this actually about the internal workings of the movement itself, but there were many people outside of that, Nelson Mandela, for example, at every university that gave Rosa Parks an honorary degree, understood not just her value, but her status, right? She was the mother of the movement, basically. And yet, within the movement, as you said, she didn't get credit. Other people, men, took credit. Other people, men, benefited financially. And that was really disturbing because it was just yet another reminder that it wasn't, you know, she was already dealing with having to fight as a Black American, but then within the movement that she was very responsible for, if not creating, then making successful, she suffered as a woman. And I don't know that, has there been that much change since then?
There's definitely not a knowledge about it. I mean, this was not the first time, we now know in retrospect, that the civil rights movement really wrote out the history of women.
Yeah.
You know, to the point almost like you would have thought women weren't in it at all, except for some tiny little portions. And we know that not to be true. So some people have gone back and done histories. And because of that, I think there's just a bigger sense of, we need accurate representation of how things are, who's really responsible, what really happened. It reminds me of during the Me Too movement, you know, that people were like, no, here's how it started. Like, let's not write out the people who have been doing this work for a while. Or whenever there's, you know, bail reform, right? There's this idea that, you know, some celebrity walks through and they got it done. And you're like, well, actually, there have been people on the ground who've been working at this for a long time. And it's really important to remember and name them, because they, you know, they've been doing it. But yeah, it's, I think that was exactly part of what was going on in the civil rights movement. It was really misogynistic in a lot of ways, right? Just women were not given the credit. And sometimes people would say, well, they very much held support roles. And I would say, yes, and they held support roles, and they were also doing other kinds of leadership, and they still didn't get support. So it's not just toiling away in the background. You know, that wasn't really the case. It is sort of incredible to me that someone like Rosa Parks, whose story everybody knows, the idea that, you know, that she and her husband made $700 one year by evidence by their tax return is insane. And you have to wonder, like, did people not know that she was struggling? Her relative said that, you know, she was proud. She never would have said anything. But you know, my experience is people always know. People know who's working. People know who's not working. People know. She just never benefited from a thing that she was very responsible for.
Yeah. And people know if you're getting paid for work you're being asked to do or not. And as the documentary points out, there were times when she was traveling constantly, but pro bono. Not getting compensated for her work. And as you said earlier, it wasn't until John Conyers hired her to be on his staff that she actually had health insurance, which is both absurd and tragic. Right. That this woman who essentially was the face, acknowledged by the movement or not, of the fight for equality in America is sort of a very sad commentary and a damning indictment. And it makes me wonder, curious what you think of this, what would have happened? How things might have been, and I know this is speculation, but because this country seems to be so trapped in its inability to reckon with its past, I wonder how things would have been different if Rosa Parks had been able, had been supported, had mm-hmm. been able to take on the kind of leadership role and have that acknowledged mm-hmm. and compensated.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't know that you'll ever know. I do know right. when, you know, remember when they were literally eulogizing her and her body was laying in state. At that very same time, they were overturning, the Supreme Court was overturning voting rights, right? Like, so literally yeah. on the left hand, you know, saying this, but on the right hand, literally doing the opposite. And so I think that's the big tragedy, right? And ultimately, yeah. someone asked me the other day, you know, are you optimistic or pessimistic? And I'm like, I don't know, both. You know, I think yeah. there's tremendous reasons for optimism and then tremendous reasons for pessimism. I think this hypocrisy of one, you know, honoring Rosa Parks, but actually dishonoring and dismantling the very thing that she's known for doing, you know, is kind of crazy.
That to me is worse than replacing Ruth Bader Ginsburg with Amy Coney Barrett, which is really quite horrific, just symbolically. So the fact that her statue, Rosa Brooks' statue, is of her sitting down, of course, which again distills her life into a moment of passivity and gets it wrong. It gets the story wrong, and representation really matters. And that's why I think that this documentary is so important and should be seen. Well, it should be seen by everybody, but you know, it's one of those things that should be in schools.
We actually have the author of the book, upon which the doc is based, Jean Thea Harris, has written a children's book, a book for young adults as well.
Oh,
and so we were able to get a grant from the Ford Foundation in order to be able to kind of extend the reach of the doc itself for this very reason. Like, we can't say all these things and be like, thanks for watching.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
You have to actually, what do you do to make sure that the next generation isn't limited like we were limited in our understanding? I agree with you. I think there's so much power in history. It's a lot of the work that I do, trying to understand, well, why was this bridge built here? Why does this highway run through this neighborhood? Why does the highway not run through this neighborhood? How come these people have no access to the highway? You know, and you begin to really realize that so much of the underpinnings of America are really very intentional and very yeah. biased and very discriminatory at times. And so really digging into, like, why did we do what we do? I mean, learning that... Robert Moses, you know, who really, when I grew up, we used to cut out of school and go to Jones Beach and all the yep. places that Robert Moses really developed, you know, to keep people out from he did not want undesirables coming from New York City. You know, he made sure that the overpasses were too low for big buses to come out, right? Like, very intentional yeah. discrimination. And Rosa Parks said, you know, I was no more tired than I was any other at the end of any other workday.
Right.
I was just tired of being treated this way.
Yeah.
And I always thought, like, ugh, that's what she was trying to say, you know, and everyone literally misunderstood it. People just got it wrong. She was just tired of white supremacy. She's like, I am tired of white supremacy, so I'm not getting up. I think if people had heard that message, it might have been very different in how, you know, I'm not sure that she would be eulogized and honored by George Bush and by all the colleges that she was honored. Like, it might, you know, I think if people had known how rebellious she was, it might have been a bit of a different story.
Yeah, I can't remember which historian it was, but this really brilliant woman who was interviewed says that, you know, if people had known who she really was, if people had seen who she's sort of hanging out with, they might have been a little bit scared. Yeah. And I love that because, as somebody else said, that, like, that was sort of her superpower.
Yeah.
You know, she presents what I don't think she presented herself in any way except as who she was. But that got interpreted how people wanted it to be interpreted. But, you know, she was hanging out with people like Robert F. Williams, who founded the Black American Guard, which advocated for arming Black citizens so they could defend themselves against the Ku Klux Klan.
Right? Black Panthers, mm-hmm. Malcolm X, at the same time, Dr. King. I mean, contradictions and just kind of led to this idea of this woman is much more nuanced and complicated than, you know, what she was given credit for in a lot of ways. And I hadn't realized that the young woman who first sat on the bus, who got arrested, Claudette Colvin, mm-hmm. Knew Rosa Parks. She actually was, you know, they were connected. Yeah. Again, you know, it wasn't just someone did it first. And, you know, it was this connection of people who were all working toward justice. It's a fascinating doc because history is so important. It's, I think, why we're seeing what we see today of people who are trying to rewrite history or remove parts of history or pretend things happened in history that just did not happen at all. You know, history is very powerful.
Yeah. And you mentioned Robert Moses, and I think this is something else that comes through in the documentary, that it wasn't only the overt violence, which was unspeakable and coordinated and also sanctioned by law enforcement and the government, et cetera. But it was the social isolation and this social exclusion, like making it impossible for buses in New York to drive out to Long Island to go to the beach, because most Black people back then didn't own cars. They had to take the bus. And Robert Moses, who I think is like the poster boy of institutionalized racism, made it impossible for Black people to enjoy what any other American citizen could enjoy, a day at the beach. And it also made it difficult, if not impossible, for white and Black Americans to coexist. So that's also what we learn in this documentary, that Rosa Parks wasn't just fighting all of it, but she was in some ways like a more of a victim of it than a lot of other people who were fighting the same fight.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And it's so insidious and it's so intentional. You know, what I learned about Robert Moses, and that, you know, having grown up in Long Island, right? So I knew all those landmarks very well. And you're just like, oh my gosh, that wasn't accidental. That wasn't just like, oops, or it was just done so many of these things, you know, the structural racism, right? Are literally putting things in place very intentionally to keep people down. And that's exactly what Rosa Parks was fighting against. And I'm always amazed that she wasn't disheartened. You know, you don't find a lot of interviews where she just says, like, I can't go on. You could probably go to my Twitter feed and find me saying, I can't go on, like, 50 times. But, like, there's literally no place in all of her writings where she's sort of saying, that's it, I'm out. I can't do it anymore. And I think we would be like, oh, well, that makes perfect sense.
I say that at least 10 times a day to myself.
Everybody says, here's why, hashtag, here's why I'm leaving New York. but, you know, you don't get the sense that for her, it was something that you could move on from, that it was just, and I think you're right. There was no sense that it was gonna be solved in your lifetime. Like literally, you know, it's that Recy Taylor. We're doing this not for us. You're not getting justice. She knows, I know, you know, everybody knows no justice will come of this. But one day someone's gonna look back at these notes and say, whatever did happen with this woman, and the fact that there is a record and it's the truth and it's and it exists is important. And I think she was always sort of fighting for that, right? This idea of like, these things exist, they're here.
Yeah. And, you know, that also showed this willingness of hers to take on more burdens as if she needed more burdens. And with the understanding that it was for posterity and future generations. But I, you know, I think that she just didn't think stopping was an option. So, you know, why complain if you know that you have to persevere? I don't know, but it is remarkable what a human being she was, you know, what a titan, it, as her nephew said, 5'1", 100 pounds soaking wet.
Yeah, no, it's and all played into that story and that narrative, right? I think if she had been big and she had been loud and she had been, you know, none of that would have worked. And my guess is she probably wouldn't have been honored in the way she was. In a way, you know, it all played into the narrative of I'm a grandmotherly type figure who just one day, you know, we're bothering her.
Yeah, and that cuts both ways. I mean, that just made me really sad, actually.
Yeah, it does. It does. It actually, but there's some value in understanding that changing things takes time and takes work. And it's not hashtags and, you know, hey, everybody show up on this Saturday to do this thing. Like, you know, democracy is worth fighting for. Justice is worth fighting for. But it's a long freaking haul done, you know, at every level. And I think sometimes we miss that message.
Yeah. And again, I don't think she was playing a role by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think she understood the value of being subversive. And that, I think that is the long-term strategy. And, you know, every once in a while, that reaches its limits, but that can be incredibly effective. Unfortunately, we find ourselves living in a time that does feel, especially since the Supreme Court ruling in Shelby v. Holder, on the day Rosa Parks' statue was unveiled, which gutted the Voting Rights Act. And now it looks like they're gunning for the entire, whatever's left of it, honestly. Do you see this as sort of a piece, like it's a pretty unbroken arc? Or is there a way that we can kind of change the narrative so we at the very least put the brakes on what seems to be the dismantling of, I mean, look, you get rid of the Voting Rights Act, you get rid of American democracy.
You know, I think at the end of the day, one of the biggest challenges with American democracy, as much as I have an issue with the political press, which I do often, people have to understand what they have and they have to value it and they have to vote to protect it. And I think that sometimes you don't necessarily get that coverage. All right. I think voting is treated like a game and not something important at all levels, certainly in terms of our coverage, but also in terms of, you know, what do you don't even get the day off. And so, yeah, I think that we need certain things have woken up. I think some people, I truly believe the election will show that more women and more young women have suddenly realized what's at stake, maybe late in the game. But I think there are lots of indications that you'll see those numbers increase. And people will realize that, you know, again, these things aren't accidentally, you know, that rights are fought for, and deconstructing how civil rights are won and how they're lost, you know, they're always a long game and they're very intentional. Yeah. So I always think that there's time. I always think that it requires people to be engaged with their democracy. I think the fact that we even, you know, I used to work for CNN. I left there about 10 years ago, just under 10 years ago. And we never talked about democracy. Right. But we talk about it all the time. And
right.
I think that's important. Like, I think that's a big shift.
Yeah.
We never used the words white supremacy. I did 9 Black and America documentaries. We never used the words white supremacy.
Right.
Very intentionally. I mean, one hand, people would tell me not to do it. And on the other hand, I was also like, well, who would even understand it? Like, oh my God, I didn't take a whole half an hour to like divert over here to give an explainer. You know, now that conversation is so typical that we could have it, you know, you're having it in the evening news. So I do think there are some big shifts, but they take time and they require a populace to become engaged, and they require journalists who cover politics to do a good job to serve their public and help them understand what's happening.
Yeah, sorry, I'm smiling because one of my favorite things is your Twitter feed.
I've got some people, young people, who are like,
seriously,
like,
man.
All they think I ever did is Twitter. They're like, so yeah, I only know you. You used to work at CNN.
Well, that's very funny. Well, I know.
Twitter doesn't pay any money. Right? You realize like that's a free job. That's not a job.
Cannot monetize Twitter. No, but seriously, it's like a masterclass in journalism because you don't just, although one of my recent favorite tweets of yours was a response to a post by a mainstream journalist, and you just wrote, "Just so dumb."
I know.
It's like an evergreen tweet.
I love when people write good, thoughtful things. So I'm like, oh, this is what I was trying to say. I wrote this mean thing that was kind of sassy and just, ugh. But this person wrote a 1,000-word essay that's actually quite smart and what I was trying to say.
But it's important to be that direct. And to be fair, those aren't the only kinds of tweets. You will point out an egregious misleading headline or a poorly thought out take that a journalist has on something. And you'll ask the question, you know, what is the problem here? You know, what was a better way to frame this?
Framing, right? Framing is everything. And I think once people realize like the power that the journalists have is in framing. So let's do the testimony by the young woman who talked about Trump throwing the ketchup and you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And I remember thinking, she has her testimony minutes later. It was Peter Alexander, actually, I think he's at NBC News. I don't know, who said, you know, he had his sources were saying what she was lying, that in fact, those people were going to testify to the exact opposite. Right. So she's full of it was basically what he was saying. And you sit there and think like, you know, here's a reporter, essentially, and those people never came forward, right? There was no indication it was all wrong. But, you know, like, so the framing, what is the point? What is the reason? Why would people tell him this? Why is he pushing this theory? How does this help? Who are his sources? What can we learn by this information that we're getting? When a story is told in this particular way, I always think, you learn a lot about the journalist and you learn a lot about the power and also where are they coming from, right? Even as they say, I'm not biased or whatever, you actually see how you frame a story is very much your bias, your position on it. And so I often try to get people like understand, ask yourself, why is the story being framed this way? Why is the story of a young woman who's shot by the police as she's, you know, as she's running toward them? Her dad had taken her hostage earlier, never really framed as the police shot her, right? She's killed in her escape, you know?
Yeah, and she's wearing a tactical vest or something.
And it's not till days later that the story begins to kind of come together. Like, oh, so-and-so shot her. You know, police involved. My favorite was always a police involved shooting. You're like, what does that mean? A police involved, you know, shooting. So I like clarity and I like to understand what someone's point of view and what's their framing, because that's going to give me a lot of insight into where they're coming from and where they're probably, I can guarantee you that Peter Alexander's sources called him and lied to him and said, you know, which he then immediately, right, to counter, you know, who was he working for at that moment? Was he working for the understanding of his audience or was he basically being used? And I would argue, you know, he was probably being used by people who were absolutely making stuff up.
And that strikes me as one of our biggest challenges right now, this whole concept of access journalism and what journalists are willing to either to sell, if it's okay for me to put it that way, to listeners, readers, viewers, or what they're willing to withhold so they can write a book a couple of years later when the information isn't really news anymore.
Well, I think there's a couple of things at work, as you know, right? Which is one, you have to have something to say in your book. I remember when I wrote my memoir, they're all like, but don't you have a good story? I grew up middle class in Long Island. Like, I have no, you know, nothing bad happened to me. And so, you know, but people, as you know, want to hear, like, what's the juicy nugget that we're going to push? So you need that. You're going to have a book. Anybody who's ever written a book knows that. And I also think, you know, it's in some ways not complicated at all. When you have access, you can be a good reporter. Right. It gives you good information. It gives you interesting information. It allows you every single day to say, nobody else is going to have this, but I have a special relationship. I'm an insider here. And I've got this. This is, I'm going to break news. So sometimes I think people get confused. Like, you can't be a good reporter and also leverage your access. Your access journalists just, you know, leverage that access to sometimes report favorably. Right. It helps, you know, they help their source in some capacity. It's very easy to do. There's been many, many words recently written about, you know, that this person's a great reporter. Well, you can be a great reporter, but you can also, and you can see lots of examples of, this is a really good example. I'll use Maggie Haberman as an example, since it's her book that's coming out and a lot has been written about her, right? This is a similar protest, she wrote, as to the anti-Trump protest when January 6th was happening. There's not a soul who thought that. When people storming the Capitol, with a gallows. that is the oddest take. And when she tweeted that, by the way, it wasn't like, oh my God, the first 8 minutes of it where it looked like people's just a bit of a melee, right? It was literally the tweet she was responding to was someone talking about how absolutely horrific it was. And her response was, well, it's, you know, similar to the ones, right? Like, let me, what is the framing of, what is this person's point of view? If that's your take, I'm just telling you, if you have a lot of sources, you're constantly trying to make sure, and you're going to need them later for a book. When I do interviews, if I have something tough, I've got to ask somebody. I save it for the end. I can't have them walk out the first 1 minute of my interview.
Oh, that's good to know.
Let's start with all the hard questions. You know, you do everything, and what's your favorite book? And tell me a little bit about blah, blah, blah. Right. And then at the end, you're like, before you go, a couple of things we got to get to, you know, and then you see what you're going to get out of that. But, you know, they might be so mad. They're going to rip the mic off and they're going to storm out of the room. Right? That might happen. But by then you've gotten enough stuff to use. And so the idea that somehow you don't try to keep a source who's going to be an important person in your book happy by when you can, just constantly, you know, thinking like, well, this was very similar to the other protests. I don't understand why people find that so hard to believe. And you can break news and be a good reporter at times. Those two things aren't mutually exclusive.
Yeah. And it's hard to know who that kind of framing serves anyway. I've been wanting to ask you this for a long time. And notice I kept it until the end. No, I'm kidding. It's really not that kind of question. One of the things that has most shocked me in the last 6 years is the extent to which the media, American mainstream media, seems unconcerned about or unwilling to challenge the threats to its own journalists. And, you know, for 4 or 5 years, they were called the enemy of the people. Some journalists were physically endangered, physically threatened. And yet there was no push. It's almost like they needed to normalize it. And I'm not surprised that the mainstream media, you know, the corporate side would necessarily have a problem with that. But the individual journalists who seem to have moved on, when we are, as you said, in the midst of this crisis of democracy, and, you know, a free press can't survive without democracy. So has that shocked you, surprised you, or have you seen this coming?
No, I think you're in the middle of a big story, and your relevance is you're in the middle of that big story. And I don't, you know, I think it's a little bit of why people liked Trump while also hating Trump, right? Is that you knew if you booked him, you're going to get ratings and you're going to get numbers. And so, you know, it made sense, even though he was very hard to interview and he's, you know, and you're going to get chaos and this and that, you know, that. So I think it's that It's why you go and stand out in a hurricane, right? Because you put yourself in danger because, one, you've got to, you know, bring the story, but also because it's how you make your name. It's important. And that danger in and of itself makes the story more dramatic, right? I mean, I think if you're really nervous about your reporters, you could just put a camera up, right? And yeah, literally could just capture what was being said. So I don't know why. I think that it was just too juicy. Why just throw up a camera shot of a podium that no one's there with a countdown clock? Yeah, it just makes no sense, right? So you're clearly trying to, it's not news. It's not newsworthy. It's not even explanatory in any way.
Right.
It's just bullshit. And it was such a low in how we thought about covering these rallies, which were disturbing and scary for people. I was more scared sometimes for people in the audience.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have the corporate entity behind them.
That's right.
They didn't have, somebody there on their behalf. So yeah, it's just been very, very disappointing. But I think ratings, conflict gets you ratings, and ratings gets you success, and and slings and arrows can all also help you with your name recognition. So I think there's some of this weird symbiotic relationship, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I remember when Jonathan Carl wrote a book, it was called Front Row at the Trump Show. And I was just like, wow, who calls their job that? You have one of the most interesting and important jobs in journalism, period, full stop, which is a pretty cool job as just a category.
Yeah.
And you see your job as you sit in the front row of the Trump Show, like what an embarrassment. And it was poorly reviewed, but I actually didn't mind it. I thought it was kind of interesting. But I just thought, like, wow, this is such a sad take on how journalists think about what they do. It really is.
And it's a huge shift. Helen Thomas was a White House correspondent. And now it seems like, according to reporters I've spoken to, like Brian Karam, the people who get those jobs now are like right out of school with no experience. So it's not even taken with the seriousness the job deserves. So it is kind of seen as jockeying for position and getting the right quote.
A lot of our business is that. If I got to cover big breaking news stories, that was going to help my career. I also wanted to go tell important stories, but yes, there were certain parts of me that were also like, being put on a big story is a big deal for your career. Absolutely. And so again, anybody who pretends otherwise is just lying to you. You can still want to do a good job. You can still be a good reporter. That's the reality of it. You need to get on the big stories in order to get the next big story, in order to get, the name recognition and to build your career and be moved into the next thing. Covering politics is one really good way to do that.
Yeah. And that, look, I that makes sense. And I think it's good to hold individual reporters accountable, but also we have to understand that they have to exist within this particular culture. And a lot of them are getting their orders from the top, and they have to follow the story that's in front of them. But sometimes it does feel the dangerous part is who's making the decision about what is worth covering. So we get Donald's rallies being covered, but not one of the major broadcast channels televised Joe Biden's extraordinarily important speech about what's happening in the right wing in this country and the dangers it's posing to our democracy. That's really disturbing.
Yeah. And those decisions, and by the way, that list could go on and on, right? Mm-hmm. You'll get a point of view. I mean, the number of things I've been in where it's a bunch of guys discussing women's rights, or a bunch of guys, usually that's how it goes, a bunch of white guys talking about the black vote, where you're just like, if you ever have something happening in a minority community, many news organizations discovered that they had decent size Asian community, but no reporters who fluent in a foreign language who could help them report on a breaking news story about violence, especially among elderly Asian people who are being attacked, in the streets, like horrific. But, you know, how do you get that story? Well, you look around and you're like, I don't have the reporting body to do that. So, yeah, how do you think about what you're going to cover? How do you think about who you're going to hire? That's the power of the ownership and the production team, right? What is the narrative? If that's back to framing, what is the narrative that we think is important today? There are meetings that literally say that. Today, the stories are this. This is what we cover. And you have a couple of people in those meetings who are like, actually, should we think we could add in this voice or that voice? But, you know, often it's, we want to hear from these three people.
Right.
And that's how you get the mythology around, you know, Paul Ryan is a policy wonk and this person's really good on this and that. You know, it's just people's own bias in, you know, how they see something. And that's the framing is what you get. You get their own bias writ large.
Yeah. And as you said, we are I don't know if you put it this way, but we're at this point, it feels like a crossroads to me, but we are talking about what's happening in this country in terms of democracy. We are using language that's accurate and appropriate. Like we talk about white supremacy. We talk about fascism. You know, it took 3 years for the media to call a lie a lie, but now we're using the word lie.
I felt like I was helping to lead the charge on that one. I feel like we should have all gotten fruit baskets when that happened. You're like, I don't I get a fruit basket for finally after shaming and harassing people?
And I was like, how fucking long do I have to be doing this?
We call this just lying, right? Unverifiably untrue. I think the New York Times like to say it's verifiably untrue. You're like, it's just a lie.
It's three letters, for God's sakes. You would think that they would want to be saving there.
So,
but congratulations for finally making it happen.
I got a fruit basket. I'm sure it's on its way.
I'm sure George Soros is
sending us all fruit baskets. And the global elites. I think the global elites should be sending me a fruit basket soon.
I think you should be getting several, actually. But they seem to be behind schedule with the checks and the fruit baskets. And I still haven't gotten my check. So it's just a little disappointing. Not as well organized as people would have us be on the globalist stage. But, I so appreciate how important your work is and how I just love the way you don't pull punches. I guess that's the simplest way for me to put it, because it gives me faith that that there are journalists who understand what's at stake, who understand how to meet this very difficult situation we find ourselves in head on, without fear or favor. And you model the kind of professionalism we really need right now. And I feel like you're leading the charge there. And I know, you know, obviously your show is, I love your show. Matter of fact, you dig deep on important issues that may not be on everybody's radar all the time, that need to be centered. And like even, some of your interviews on Real Sports, you recently interviewed Carrie Blakinger, which was just like, it came out of left field. It's like, what is this about? And, you know, you got in this incredibly important story about the horrible state of our prisons through
through an ice skater. She was an ice skater. That's right. Real Sports. Got to be about sports in there somewhere.
But it was phenomenal. Yeah, and I think the ways in which you approach things, really, they make them accessible for people and help people understand just what is at stake, and where we're not paying attention because there's so much going on. You know, the world is kind of in a crazy place right now. And I also can't think of a better time for this documentary.
That's good. And it's, you know, I think it does really, in a way, I feel like we're the end piece of what Rosa Parks was going for, you know, like that someone else would pick up the threads and say, you know what, it's not forgotten. The facts are important. And maybe no one understood the record at the moment, but at some point they will. And I think that we're putting down that flag with this doc.
Well, again, it's the rebellious life of Rosa Parks. It's brilliant. It's a necessary watch. And, you know, everybody should not just be watching it, but promoting it. So I really appreciate you taking time to be here today. It was so great to meet you and to get to spend some time with you.
Yeah,
and say hi to your horses and your puppy.
I will, and the dogs who are outside. Thanks for having me. Appreciate
all right, thank you so much. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you so much to Soledad O'Brien. That was such a great conversation. I learned so much from the documentary, The Rebellious Life of Rosa Parks, that I hadn't known about what is very recent American history and that all of us should be familiar with, especially those white people among us who don't understand just what people like Rosa Parks went through, what they represent, and where we are as a country in terms of our very serious racial divisions and white supremacy, white privilege, and all of the rest of it. So please watch it. It's streaming on Peacock, The Rebellious Life of Rosa Parks. Soledad was an executive producer. She, again, also is the host of Matter of Fact with Soledad O'Brien. And she's a correspondent for Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. Both shows are excellent. And thank you to all of you for joining us this evening. I so appreciate you being here. We will be back next Tuesday, 12 p.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, with the Nerd Avengers, grappling with whatever it is has come up in the meantime. And of course, join us again next Thursday for our regular show. That's at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. Both of those you can see at youtube.com/Politicon. And when you go to Politicon's YouTube page, please subscribe to Politicon so we can increase our number of subscribers. That's always very helpful. Doesn't cost anything. Like the episode. And if you click on this bell, you will be sure to be alerted every time a new video drops. And it's not just our regular shows. We have our emergency sessions. We live stream the January 6th committee. We live stream any important speeches that might be happening. And, you know, anything else that comes up, plus the short videos I've been doing to kind of in between to try to stay ahead of the chaos. And of course, you can listen to this in podcast form on Apple or wherever you find your pod or wherever you like to listen to your podcast. And if you give the show a 5-star review, that would be fantastic because it helps everybody else find the show. And that's our goal here as we are very short time out from the 2022 midterm elections, which again, hate to be repetitive, are the most consequential elections of our lifetime. Thank you all again for being here, for your comments. I so appreciate all of you, and I will see you next Tuesday. In the meantime, have a great weekend. Stay safe and be kind.
You eat well, you work out, but did you know 99% of Americans are still mineral deficient? That's where Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder comes in. It's your daily foundation for better mood, natural energy, immune support, and nervous system balance. Formulated from nature and backed by science, it's a simple habit that makes a big impact. Because your body doesn't make minerals, and today's food and water don't supply enough, with Concentrace, you'll feel the difference. Go to tracemineralz.com and start with minerals. Start with Concentrace.